Hello, I'm Professor Elemental, and whenever I'm not riding a badger around my grounds or hitting my monkey butler with a stick, I'm listening to the Geek Show, and my God, I love it.
Stay a while. Stay forever.
Hello and welcome to a much more traditional episode of News Trash here on The Geek Show, where we go over the past week's news and events from the video games world, which is a bit of a different status quo this week, but we will get a lot in due course. I am Rob, and as ever, I've been joined by Prob. Hello there.
Hello!
Yes, it's been E3. I mean, you can't really have ignored it, which essentially swallows up all the news. So
yeah,
we did release two videos. They're just going to stay videos because I was pondering about putting them on the podcast feed, but when you're constantly referring to things in a video, it seems kind of mean-spirited. So it's just going to stay as pure videos, though. So if you listen to this one on the podcast feed, head over to our YouTube where we've got two big old long videos on the events and then key trailers from E3. Key trailers as in ones which interest us, so there might be ones which you might think, why aren't they there?
Yeah,
if they're not there, it's because we're not interested.
Yeah, there's people are going to question why certain games aren't on our radar. Well, because we find them dull and boring.
Yeah, essentially. It's not about chasing the trends, it's about finding what you find interesting. I think that when you get to a certain age of being a gamer, that is basically everything.
Yeah, and we will be giving our thoughts about E3 as an actual event a bit later on in this episode, so stay tuned for that, because we do have thoughts and we do have opinions on that front. But before then, we've got some news to share with everybody.
It's amazing that some news snuck out.
Yeah, actually, there's two bits of Xbox news which are very, very surprising, and I kind of feel like a weight has been lifted off my shoulders because of these pieces of news. I kind of feel, you know, that what's that word? You know, when you make a bold statement, but then everyone kind of says, "No, that's never going to happen," and then it turns out that you were actually right all the time.
Yeah, I think you're focusing too much on other people's opinions, Rob. But go on.
Right. I said there's a very big possibility that Xbox, that Game Pass, could go down the route of Amazon, Netflix, that sort of thing. Everyone kind of went, don't think that's going to happen. Well, in the first piece of news, Microsoft have announced that they're working on an Xbox TV app and its own xCloud streaming stick, a la the Amazon Fire Stick.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, they're working with TV manufacturers to make an Xbox TV app available on devices very soon.
The problem with the TV app is some TV companies don't really update TVs, so it's really only targeting people who have like new TVs or high tech bleeding tech TVs.
Exactly.
And the sort of market that this is targeting towards people who don't want to buy a console and want to save the money from buying a console. It's a Venn diagram of people with expensive TVs, people who want to save money by buying consoles. There's a very small sliver of people there who this is actually relevant for.
Yeah.
If you look at the big picture, you think, oh, it looks cool. But when you break it down into what it is and what it means, it's not as revolutionary as Rob may suggest.
Yes. But here's the thing. Neither was Netflix, and this is one of those areas.
That's a very, very different thing.
It's a very different thing
in Netflix.
Just bear with me a second. Netflix, yes, is a very different thing. I accept that. But it's one of those areas where we don't know how the market is going to react to this. We have no idea. It's never been done before. And right now, it might be a small market share, but it might be a market share that grows. It might be a market share that just stays the same. It might shrink. We don't know. All I'm saying is that
the streaming stick.
Yeah. Streaming stick is
a different thing altogether.
Yeah. Streaming stick, I think, is the big thing.
The TV app is basically targeting bleeding edge TVs, whereas every sort of relatively modern TV has a HDMI port. That's where you put the Fire Stick.
Yeah.
And if they can sort of crack the input lag,
yeah,
because it will be through streaming.
Yeah.
But there's a big if there, because input lag
yes.
with streaming services has been basically the big issue. Completely. I mean,
the thing is, this all ties in at a time when Microsoft have done, they've made a big move in terms of their data centers. You know, they've been transitioning to their Azure data centers on Xbox Series X hardware.
So in human terms,
for Xbox,
their center previously was all powered from Xbox One, and now they're going to be powering up those centers to be running off Xbox Series X's.
Yeah, so the whole thing, the whole upshot of that is, it's opened up a lot more possibilities in terms of xCloud streaming, in terms of Game Pass and stuff like that for them, in terms of bandwidth usage and all sorts of other technical things, which I'm not going to go into. But one of the side effects of that is that certain Xbox Series X games will soon be available on Xbox One via cloud streaming.
But before we get to that, and it is the big elephant in the room here, this is only as good as the internet connections around the world.
Yes, yes.
And a lot of places in the UK were really behind speed. A lot of places in America behind speed. Australia, basically, forget about Australia. They don't even get a look in.
Yeah.
So for certain areas, the streaming, like through a Fire Stick or a TV app or back or forward compatible, it all essentially hinges on internet connection speed and reliability. However, if you do have that internet connection speed and reliability, it's a bit of a game changer.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the fact that I almost call them Amazon. I mean, it is such an Amazon approach, isn't it? They've basically copied Amazon's playbook with this. I mean, the fact that they're putting Game Pass as an app onto TVs and then and then you've got this stick that goes alongside it. That's Amazon's approach right down to the wire. Because a lot of people rely on their Fire Sticks, their Amazon Fire Sticks. And I think if you take away the streaming side of things and you just look at devices that people want as an addition to their TV, the Fire Stick is almost at the top of the list, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. This is kind of it's a crystallization of different philosophies between two companies.
Yeah.
On the one hand, Sony, forgetting the fact that they said generations matter and they backtracked on that, that's kind of a moot point.
Yeah.
They're very much a company based on old traditions, on this idea of having a box under the TV and you put discs into the box or you download things into the box, which basically, it kind of hamstrings the industry and stops it really evolving.
Yeah.
Whereas Microsoft are very much interested in the evolution and forwarding of the industry. However, for me, it comes back to, like, the Xbox One was ahead of its industry by many, many years in the community, the gaming industry went, no.
Yeah.
My worry here is that Microsoft, in instilling all of these things, are too far ahead of the industry and the community will go, no. Again, so they're putting all the eggs in this future basket, and the future, well, the present kind of goes, yeah, not interested, give it 5 years.
See,
and they've sank a lot of money into whatever they're plotting.
I have a different opinion to you on this. My brain automatically went back to, and I know this is going to be a slightly strange connection, but my brain went back to the Wii when I looked at everything that Microsoft was doing and how accessible they were trying to make games and how many devices they're actually making it available, making xCloud available on and Game Pass available on, making it available on Chrome-based browsers and stuff like that. You know, all of that combined into one, I thought, okay, they're making games as a medium much more accessible to the general public. So it's not so much about what gamers want, it's what will the general public look at instead. There's a lesson to be learned from the Wii and how Nintendo marketed the Wii. And I think that Microsoft, if they've got their druthers about them, then they will look at the Wii and say, right, that's how we need to do it. We need to just basically say, this is for everyone, not just for these people over here who are playing console-based games or PC-based games. Moving on to Cyberpunk. It's been a long time since we talked about Cyberpunk. It's actually coming back to the PlayStation Store.
Yeah. This is good for CD Projekt Red.
Yeah.
But I think, honestly, some people will want to buy it because they've been waiting for it and they've been anticipating it, even though they've openly said or openly hinted at not bothering with the base PlayStation 4 unit because it still can't do it.
Yeah.
That being said, I think it'd be a lot of people have been burnt and not, the interest is gone because of what happened.
Yeah. It's too late. Sony are warning that base edition PS4s will still have problems and they recommend playing the game on PlayStation 4 Pro or PlayStation 5 instead. And they have said that the game, you know, just because it's available on the PlayStation 4 again, it doesn't mean that it's fixed for standard PlayStation 4 owners.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Which should mean then they should put something on the store, which means you can't buy it if your base unit is a PS4. They should stop that because, you know,
it's going to
cause problems.
The store automatically recognizes which type of PlayStation you're on at that point and which PlayStation is registered to your PlayStation Network account. So it should put a stop on you being able to buy it if you just got a bog standard PlayStation 4.
It should.
Yeah, it should, but it probably won't.
Nah, because money.
Yeah, anyway.
I'm interested in playing it one day, but when it's like cheap on a sale.
Yeah.
Like, I might pay 15 quid for it, but other than that, no.
Yeah. Speaking of companies that like money, all of the money, right.
You mean all companies then? All companies like money, Rob. What are you talking about?
But, I mean, there's one company above all others in video games that likes money.
No, there isn't. There's about four of them, and they're all sort of, you know...
There's one above...
Activision, Blizzard, Ubisoft.
There's,
take your pick.
There's one that's more notorious than the rest. And it
Rockstar.
Is EA. Yeah, I know Rockstar. I know Rockstar, like all the money.
Your setup was bad, right?
Look, EA. Oh, go on. Right, EA. Okay. EA. Right, you know the whole palaver with loot boxes and stuff like that? And how EA kept trying to say, oh no, they're not gambling, it's surprise mechanics. Yeah? And they set so much store by the term surprise mechanics.
Surprise mechanics makes it sound like it's a strippogram who's a mechanic.
Yeah. But here's the thing, right? EA, I don't honestly know whether they've shot themselves in the foot with this or not.
Well, because they're constantly doing it, so I'd say yes, they are.
Yeah. But EA have kind of gone against the whole idea of surprise mechanics. For a limited time event, they are allowing players to basically preview the cards that'll be getting in these packs, which goes completely against the idea of surprise mechanics.
I think traditionally EA looked at loot boxes as sort of like sticker packs for like a Panini football book.
Yeah.
Even more meaningless. I mean, I'm gumming as a guy who went like swap meets with those stickers, so, you know, there's that.
This is
kind of pointless. This is pointless.
Yeah, I mean, if your whole shtick is surprise mechanics, why are you allowing people to preview what they're going to get in each pack?
It kind of makes the whole gameplay side of it meaningless. Because if you don't get what you want, you just don't buy it.
Yeah.
And then you keep refreshing it until there's something you do want to buy.
Exactly. And this is what I mean by, I think they've shot themselves in the foot, because they've all but destroyed the balance of Ultimate Team then, haven't they?
Yeah.
If it had balance in the first place. This tweak to FIFA Ultimate Team loot boxes that they've launched for a limited time event is probably going to screw with Ultimate Team in a way that I don't think EA expect.
Well, they make like, what, billions of pounds off this thing.
Yeah.
I think they'll actually make more money off it because, you know, people will only buy what they want.
Yeah.
And there's a guarantee there, whereas... You know, if it was anything like me, I'd say I buy one pack and I think, oh, that's rubbish. Buy a second pack, oh, that's rubbish. I'm not going to get any again. I'm just not going to bother. Whereas if you get your first pack and you have a good set of players, and you get your second pack and it's a good set of players, it makes you more inclined to spend because there's a bit more of a guarantee there. That might be the reasoning. I don't know, but...
Users are not going to have the option to preview a new pack until they either purchase the pack that they've previewed or until the refresher timer runs out, which is basically to a 24-hour cycle. So they have thought about that side of things a little bit, but even so, I still don't think this is going to work out the way that everyone expects, because they're going to look at the pack and go, I'll try it again tomorrow. If it's a better pack, I'll buy it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really have any horse in this race. I just want things to hurt EA as a company. That sounds really mean-spirited and malicious, but frankly, the way they've treated the gaming community has been mean-spirited and malicious, so I think maybe it's time that karma got its own back on that company.
Yeah, that's weirdly enough, Rob, that kind of does open up the next story.
That's a weird bit of serendipitous segue.
It is a very weird segue, right? Now, you remember we did an impossible mission recently, and it was all about China.
Yes.
And how China is a sleeping titan of the gaming industry.
Your YouTube viewers, top right, there's a link to that video.
Well, Nico Partners are projecting that the Chinese console gaming market is going to grow in such a big way that by 2025 it will be approaching 2.5 billion.
That's pretty quick growth.
Yeah. Now, we already know there are half a billion gamers in China. We already know that. That's more than the population of America, as in the United States of America, you know, are gamers in China.
Yeah.
And that is a staggering figure when you think about it. And the Chinese games market, it's been growing in a way that nobody has expected. They've been readapting things and now making their own things in a way that nobody expected. And I am waiting for China to get into sports games because they will dominate the Asian market, I reckon, when it comes to sports games.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's proof in the pudding as far as the way the Chinese industry works. It went from being a load of copy phones to being leader of the phone market. So yeah. It's like a history of Chinese industries, or even tech industries, that shows that it's only a matter of time before the games produced will be considerable and very, very competitive for people.
In that episode we did, I made the analogy between what China have been doing with the copying and just martial arts in general. You start off by copying the basics of other people, and then you basically become, you know, reach a certain level, then you start doing your own thing.
Yeah. But this is interesting. I think it's only a matter of time before China is a centrepiece of the video game,
yeah,
you know, makeup.
And Tencent is already one of the biggest video game companies in the world.
You've got to start acting like it.
Yeah. And I think when companies like Tencent start throwing their weight around on the global stage, companies like EA will have to...
Well, let's put it another way. Tencent are kind of like a squirrel. They've been hardened nuts for a while now.
I was wondering where this was going.
They've been hardened nuts for a while now. And, you know, they just got to share the nuts with the rest of the pack of... I don't know what a collective of squirrels is called, so let's just call them a pack. It started off well, but it kind of fell to pieces, that analogy. But yeah, effectively, Tencent are hoarding a lot of nuts. Now they've just got to reap the benefit. That's a really bad analogy, but you get what I'm going for.
Mental image of the head of EA going to the head of Tencent, please can I have your nuts?
Yeah, like listeners and viewers, sometimes I forget how much of a man-child I do this show opposite, so sorry about that. Sorry.
That's it for your news for this week. There wasn't a lot because E3 was the thing that happened, and so now we're going to talk about that thing that happened. I want to say this before we get into this. I kind of expected how everything turned out. I think all of us did.
Yeah, apparently Jeff Keighley is doing Summer Games Fest because it's his... He tried to fix E3 from within, and yeah. I think he left in 2019 and he set up Summer Game Fest in 2020 to sort of muscle them out of the industry, muscle them out of that position. And I think the fact that Summer Game Fest closed with Elden Ring is a huge intent of the future of what that disruptive force that Summer Game Fest is going to have.
Yeah.
Because E3 was kind of pointless.
Yeah. There were things that came out from this E3 that didn't make for good reading for anyone who is kind of an industry observer. Rather than an industry insider or outsider or games fan in general, I think industry observers in particular were quite shocked at some of the things came out. ESA's stance on loot boxes, for example, I'll be honest, I find it totally abhorrent, their stance on loot boxes.
Well, they were defending loot boxes, the ESA, the owners of E3, the runners of E3.
Yeah. And
just to give it a bit of context here, Microsoft are at E3 in the past, but they bought the hall over the road, so they don't have to pay E3's prices and just sort of, you know, do their own thing there, but still be part of E3.
Exactly.
So that kind of tells you a little of the headspace of what was happening with that event long before the pandemic.
And Sony didn't even turn up.
Yeah. But I think that kind of, I can understand why they were doing that, because as I said before, when we talk about E3, companies prefer to control the conversation rather than share it with other people. So instead of 100 announcements drowning out 100 others, they can have the total focus and do it when they want to and control the narrative, so to speak.
Yeah.
However, that being said, without Sony, E3 felt incomplete.
Yeah, it did. It felt totally incomplete. Okay, there's something to be said for the, you know, having everybody in a hall and then some surprise celebrity comes out, a la Keanu Reeves, saying, you know, everybody's fantastic or whatever. I don't remember what the phrasing was. Oh, breathtaking, that was it. There's something to be said for all of that and the buzz you feel from the crowd and the energy from the crowd and all of that excitement. There's something to be said for that. But, right, we've been to EGX a few times, and EGX feels a bit like a trade show.
And it's not. It's a consumer show. You go and you try out the latest thing. A trade show is EG, whatever, TGS. No, not TGS. That's us. the technology trade show. I can't remember the name of it.
Oh, you mean the consumer CES?
Yeah. That's a trade show.
Yeah, but the thing is, EGX felt a bit like a trade show. E3 is a trade show.
Yeah, EGX... Eurogamer Expo for international listeners. It's basically PAX.
Yeah, and that's the thing. The layout, the fact that it's a consumer show, you can see it, but it has a little bit of the feeling of a trade show at times in certain areas. But E3 is most definitely a trade show, and that was what I think. That's one of the big failures of E3 is the fact that ESA approached it as if it's a trade show, but it's something that is very, very much based on consumers. And so it should never have moved into that category of being a trade show.
It always was a trade show.
It should never have gone to that, though.
Yeah, let's be honest. I think the state of players, the Xbox showcases, the directs, are all well and good.
Yeah.
But this E3 really showed one thing. One, Capcom, Square, Take-Two, and somebody else have no business having their own show, because effectively either they're waiting for something or they have a pre-arranged marketing agreement with either Sony or Microsoft, so Sony or Microsoft gets to unveil all the coolest things, effectively leading to like stupid, pointless events like the one which Capcom had.
Just why are they talking about, okay, I know there's a market for competitive gaming, but competitive Street Fighter is, you know, the market for that.
Yeah, I think the marketing arrangements for that are in Sony. The marketing arrangements for the new Final Fantasy or any Final Fantasy is with Sony.
Yeah.
There's other stuff which is tied up in Microsoft. So effectively, those presentations are a waste of time. Utter waste of time.
Yeah.
The PC gaming show was an advert for Razer.
Yes, it was. The PC gaming show was totally an advert for Razer. And they did have some interesting stuff on the PC gaming show, a lot more so than Square, Capcom, Take-Two, Gearbox.
Oh, yeah, sure. But it could have been like a half an hour longer, shorter. So.
Yeah. I can't remember. Was it... what was that one that was very much aimed at like younger gamers? Or was it The Wonderful...
The wholesome
diet.
Not really aimed at younger gamers, but it's more like relaxing games. But sure.
I was surprised at how much of a presence they had.
Yeah.
And I'll be honest, I probably looked through a lot more of the games on the wholesome game side than I did for just about anybody else except for Xbox and Nintendo.
Just to loop around to it, my point about E3.
Yeah.
I think there's a place for events like the old E3.
Yeah.
Because this year's E3 was essentially a YouTube playlist hosted by automatons with no feeling and no soul and no spirit. It's like they were made in a lab somewhere, and having them sort of say, these are the games that you should be excited about, be excited, is very off and alien. And just on that, there was no games to be excited about, so we really are seeing the events, the consequences of COVID this year's E3.
Yeah.
That being said, having a live crowd there, having developers show their passion, get excited about what they're doing, or being out of their depth and struggling to find something, you know, to connect the audience with, it makes those previous events have some soul, have some life.
Yeah.
The reaction of the One More Thing is amazing.
Yeah.
This year's E3 was a YouTube playlist.
Yeah,
and it was boring. And I'd rather have nothing if that's the alternative.
Yeah.
Jeff Keighley tried. He gave some sort of presentation and showmanship, but he just tried.
Which one was it? The one where they're all on like a spaceship?
I think that was...
Was that the PC one?
Yeah, PC at Ubisoft.
It wasn't Ubisoft, because Ubisoft was a joke. Ubisoft was just another playlist, like you said.
The YouTube playlist, yeah.
Yeah, with all the fake excitement and stuff like that. And that was the thing. There was no atmosphere. There literally was zero hype, zero atmosphere, zero anything.
I'm not talking about the show floor. I'm talking about the events.
Yeah.
The events thrived on atmosphere.
Yeah. And like I said, you need that buzz from the crowd. You need that excitement, that energy from the crowd, because that then you create a kind of a feedback loop. People get more and more hyped up, and they work themselves into a frenzy over whatever's coming next. I constantly think about the reaction of game trailers when basically Shenmue 3 was announced as a Kickstarter. And yeah, it was only announced as a Kickstarter, but they went nuts.
I said prior that this E3 was a sink or swim.
Yeah.
They sank.
Yeah, they sank hard.
I think Jeff Keighley is just going to up what Summer Game Fest is year on year on year. And honestly, I think next year it'll all but kill E3. Because I don't think the short games on the show are very good.
Yeah.
But Summer Games Fest is made of multiple events. But the way he did it, the way he presented it, just outdid everything E3 could possibly do.
There is another aspect of this, though, which I think plays into what's happening. And this is an aspect that I think a lot of people probably aren't going to think about. And it's to do with the types of games.
Also, just to follow that.
Yeah.
I also said prior to E3... that none of them are going to show their big daddy games.
Yeah.
Because they've got their own events down the line.
Yeah.
And I've been proved right about that as well.
Oh, yeah, you were proved right about that. The types of games, which are mainly thanks to indie games, but the types of games, the number of combat-free titles has risen since 2019. And this year, 33% of the games shown at E3 and Summer Games Fest were non-violent.
That's nice. That's a good... change of industry. That comes from a games an industry becoming more
mature,
more mainstream, I think.
Yeah, more mainstream and more mature. But this then ties in with, weirdly enough, it ties in with what I was saying about Xbox, kind of, you know, Microsoft looking at the games market and making it more accessible to just general people. Because if a third of the market then becomes non-violent games, more people will be willing to play those games, won't they?
Yeah, because games have always had that stigma of being stupid, violent games, like teenagers who have like rage problems.
Exactly. And I think that is also a thing that plays into the excitement factor. It's easy to get excited about a game where there's blood and guts spilling all over the place, or people are swinging big swords, or there's explosions, and, you know.
Well, that's just short-sightedness on the way trailers are put together.
Yeah.
Also, speaking of, trailer of the whole event is Outer Worlds 2.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Nintendo Direct led the viewership of E3 with 3.1 million people at the peak of their Direct, which is interesting.
Which is probably during Breath of the Wild.
Yeah, and the thing is, it's interesting because Nintendo have been doing these video-based conference things for a while now. So, and when you look at the difference in quality between Nintendo's and literally everybody else's, there was a massive difference.
Yeah. I don't think at Microsoft was that good. I thought the back end was amazing. The first half was absolute trash.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Microsoft, all right, according to the official awards for E3, the Microsoft presentation, Microsoft Bethesda presentation, was declared the best presentation by the official E3 awards. Now, I just want to remind everyone that Microsoft bought the hall over the road from E3.
Called it Microsoft Hall, I think, or Microsoft, yeah, something like that.
So they didn't have to be part of E3, but could run concurrently to E3. And they won the award for the best presentation.
It wasn't that good either. It wasn't that good.
That's the bit that makes me laugh the most. I just want to also point out, the most anticipated game for the entirety of E3 was Forza Horizon 5.
Yeah, because honestly, there was nothing really else which...
Yeah, nothing stood out as much as that. Yeah. That kind of stuck out like a sore thumb, and saying, hey, look, this is what we could do.
The rest was like, if there's nothing else, I'll play it. Oh, you know, that seems pretty cool. I'll give that a go. Wow, my pants are on fire with excitement.
The most apparently the most anticipated per presentation from Capcom was The Great Ace Attorney Chronicles, which, yeah, I'm not really a big fan of them anyway. From Gearbox was Tiny Tina's Wonderlands. The most anticipated indie game was Falling Frontier, which I didn't even remember being a thing.
I don't either.
You know? So I'm curious. I'm going to have to Google that because I do not remember seeing that game.
I'll put gameplay of it here just for sort of continuity, but, you know, sure. But yeah, that's it for us and E3 this year. We'll talk about other events that are coming. I think there's a EA One in July and rumours of a PlayStation 1 any week now.
Yeah.
So we'll talk about them when they happen, as well as other events down the line. I assume Warner Brothers will have one because we're strangely absent.
Yeah.
Literally every degree besides Back for Blood, which looked good, but you've got loads of things in the bank.
I am curious about a face-off between Back for Blood and the new Evil Dead game as well.
We'll see. We'll see how that plays out. But anyway, yeah, if you've got anything to add about what we've said and any story or what we sort of how we judged E3 very harshly, I admit. But if you've got anything to add to what we've said, please do comment below or fire us on social media. Fire away at us on social media. Firing us on social media is a different thing. It's kind of like being cancelled, isn't it? But a bit more official and with a letterhead.
See, this is the thing. I don't understand the whole cancellation thing. But I still exist as a person.
Time and place, Rob. Time and place. But stick around in the second half of the podcast, where we'll be talking about some of the games we've been playing, including Magnificent Truffle Pigs, Ninja Gaiden Master Collection, all sorts of things. And also, if you enjoyed the first half of the show, and the second half, for that matter, please do check out our Patreon. That's patreon.com/thegeekshow, where you can get our exclusive shows, that is Director's Lottery, in which we call it the Niche Movie Podcast without a niche, or extra episodes of our music stroke movie podcast, Pop Screen.
I'm Graham Williamson, and I like films starring pop stars. I like films about pop stars. I like films which have set design by pop stars. Probably gone a bit far there, I can't actually think of one of those. Anyway, this is why I've launched The Geek Show's new podcast, Pop Screen, where every week, me and a guest host take a look at one film, either starring by or about a pop star, and by pop I could mean anything from heavy metal to blues to disco to hip-hop, and we analyse it relentlessly, asking all of the big questions.
Ewan, who's your favourite Spice Girl?
Oh no. Can I say Richard E. Grant's my favourite Spice Girl?
And even giving some of the big answers with our unparalleled level of research and nerdishness.
I'm definitely a Beatles fan. I was on a Beatles tour taxi in Liverpool with my family, and the tour guide started referring to me for little details and to double check his facts.
So, whether you're an absolute beginner or a 24-hour party person, get swept away. I'll stop doing this now, I promise. By Pop Screen, the new podcast from the Geek Show Podcast Network. It's about music, it's about movies, it's about nonsense. We're hosted on Audioboom and available on your podcast provider of choice, as well as the Geek Show's YouTube channel. Remember to like and subscribe.
My name is Quentin Flynn. I'm here on The Geek Show. Why? Because I play Raiden in the Metal Gear series. I am Lightning, the Rain Transformed, and I have been transformed by hanging out on this show. So tune in and turn on. You'll love it. The Geek Show. It rocks.
And welcome to Marmalade, The Geek Show's regular look back at the more prominent games that we've been playing, the things that have kind of stuck with us over the last month. How are you, anyway, this week?
Compared to last month, you know, I've got a PlayStation 5 now, so, you know, I tried Xbox.
Yes, you did.
Xbox ain't for me.
Yeah.
You know, you could say, oh, that makes you a Sony pony, but, I mean, even as it's sort of an insult, a Sony pony, I mean, I'd love to be a pony, you know, I could frolic free in the fields and, you know, do as I wish and not have to get a job and, you know, pay taxes. Why wouldn't you want to be a pony?
Hey, if anyone out there wants to give me a pony, pony is also a slang term for a £50 note, isn't it?
Well, in London, yes.
So, if people want to give me ponies, you know, I'll have as many of those £50 notes as possible.
And we've talked about this before, you know, I mean, there's this idea that you've either got to be one thing or another, and if you like one thing, you hate another thing. It's just become really tedious. I mean, there's this other thing as well, where a lot of people say, I like all games, so I've got all consoles. That's not maintainable for lots of people.
No, I basically have all consoles, but I rarely use all of those consoles.
Yeah, you've got to find out what works here. And I thought, you know, I was sick of PlayStation, and I thought, you know what, I'll try something else. I'll try Xbox this generation. It wasn't to be, you know. So I went back to the comforting bosom of Sony. Fair enough. It's a bit not very ambitious of me, but, you know, it's what it is.
Yeah, it's what you're used to, and at the end of the day, that's fine. It's not that you hate Xbox or anything like that, it's just you're not used to the environment, and that's fine.
Yeah, it's just a set of games that don't really jam with my taste, as I think we talked about in last month's Marmalade.
Yeah.
You know, I played games which basically, I have really old, but I'm multi-format when it had Games Pass. So, I try.
And see, this is the thing that always confuses me about this whole argument that you're either in the Sony camp or the Microsoft camp or the Nintendo camp, and you can only be in one of those places. The thing that confused me is that people, by their nature, don't actually work that way. You know, in terms of their mentality, in terms of the psychology of just human beings in general, we don't work like that.
Let's not get into psychology, because you kind of trot that out every time I bring up this talking point.
But I'm just saying that it's weird and kind of unnatural for people not to keep their options open and not to explore.
Yeah, and it's also the suggestion that if you play games, you have to be absolutely in on games.
No.
But that's another topic for another day. But anyway, we've got games to talk about. I've got two games, which is technically four games, but it's two games this month. So,
well, I've got three games, which are definitely three games. So,
I'll let Rob sort of bookend the show.
Okay. Because I was confused by the two games, which are technically four games.
Well, if you got one of those Atari connections, that was... Because in a recent episode of, News Trash, Atari popped up, so I thought, oh, Atari haven't got any games. Should have put footage from one of those old collections, and thought, no. But one of those games is basically like 40 games, isn't it, technically?
Yes, it is. Anyway... I'm going to start off with a really, really, really good-looking game. And, I mean, this game is just, like, it's just fantastic. The scenery in it is amazing. It's developed by Thunkt, and it's... I mean, AMC have a games wing. Who knew AMC had a games wing?
Don't AMC,
do The Walking Dead and stuff like that, yeah. And
I don't know what else to do. I mean, nobody outside of America knows what else to do.
And yet, when this game started up, I was like, AMC do games? When did that happen? So, yeah, this is... I know, it's bizarre. But, you know, this is The Magnificent Truffle Pigs, which is, weirdly enough, I think it's kind of the game that I had to just pick up and play as soon as I saw it, because I'm a big fan of a BBC series, a little BBC series called The Detectorists, which is all about metal detecting. I know, I'm not a metal detector myself. I don't go out in the fields with a metal detector with the head. With
I'm going to say you're not on. A metal detector, so you're not carried by a really long person and you make bing noises whenever you pass metal. Because that would make you a very... That's a king crab. And I'll have none of it here.
No, I'm not. You've thrown me completely with that.
Your wording. You got to be careful of your wording, remember.
Just... No, talk about handles.
Anyway, the Magnificent Truffle Pigs, which when I saw the name... I saw the name before I saw the game, and it made me think of sort of... I don't know, but sort of like... adventure game with kids, mascot characters, sort of like pigs going off and doing magnificent RPG adventures. But reality is very, very different than what my imagination conjured.
Let me just say, Mackenzie Crook and Toby Jones in the BBC series, they, you know, as soon as I watched Detectorists, I just fell in love with the characters and just the whole weird idea of metal detecting as a pastime and just the weird rivalries and just the... Just kind of, it's like a very kind of, there's a weird gang culture in metal detecting. I did not know this until I watched Detectorists. And so when I saw Magnificent Truffle Pigs, I thought, it's got metal detectors, I'm sold. I want to know more. Not that I'm going to buy a metal detector and go around the beaches or the fields, but I want to know more. Immediately, I'm curious. And the scenery is beautiful. You know, everything is just stunning in the game. Just the entire scenery, everything like that.
Isn't this from the guys who did Everybody's Gone to the Rapture?
Thunked, yeah.
Yeah, which is kind of a game which put them completely on the map.
Yeah, it's kind of... the thing is, I think it is by the guys who did Everybody's Gone to the Rapture, but also kind of not as well, because I think it's some of the people who did that who went on to do this... And other people who worked on Everybody's Got the Rapture stayed with, like, and did other things.
Okay, so it's like ex-members. Yeah, fair enough.
Magnificent Truffle Pigs, it's a slightly bizarre game. It is a walking simulator, quite literally. In like, the truest sense of the word, it's a walking simulator. You walk pretty much everywhere with your metal detector looking for bits in the ground. And it is a slow game. I mean real slow. Really, really slow.
You see, that's a problem with me. I mean, it's the same with movies. And the term slow burn is used a lot, but a lot of movies that are described as slow burn have no burn at all. They're just slow, because the burn means you have to build something.
Yeah. There is a little bit of a burn there, but it's more like, you know, when you're a kid and you do the Chinese burns on someone's arm. It's more like that.
Horrible and, you know, scarring for life.
No. Just kind of as if someone who doesn't really have a good grip, like, you know, like a 2-year-old is trying to give an adult man a Chinese burn, but it's, you know, you can feel the friction.
Okay, so it's a bit too slow for my taste, essentially. You're really torturing the metaphor, so I'm going to cut you off. It's really, really slow is the point you are making.
Yes, I mean, not just slow in terms of narrative, it's also slow in terms of just how you move. You basically are slow.
That's by definition of walking simulators, isn't it? It's one of those jarring things where you think, why don't they just run?
I mean, if I had a metal detector, I would literally be running around the fields with a metal detector rather than walking, but apparently that's not how they work. You've got to give them time to detect things.
Okay.
So, yeah, you play as a guy called Adam who has been called by his one-time childhood friend... can't remember what her name is. And after a certain point, I kind of didn't care what her name was because she was a little bit annoying.
Okay.
She's desperate to find some earring, which is the other half of an earring she found as a kid in the fields of the Stanning Farm, and the Stanning Farm has been sold, so you only have a week before the developers move in to dig everything up. And she wants to find the other earring because that was the happiest time of her life. And I just thought, they're not torturing this analogy much, are they? The happiest time in her life was when she was a kid with her friends and her parents with a metal detector, and she found this earring, and that made her the center of attention. And she you know, the for some reason it's impossible for her to correlate or to extrapolate how that could reflect in her adult life. I want to kind of talk some sense into her, or just, you know, just say, look, you need some professional help.
I've got to say this to you, Rob, but, you know, video game characters aren't real people.
I know, but, you know, it's just, there's a lot of dialogue that happens, and you are in the role of Adam, and yes, you have certain dialogue choices. You can be cruel, or you can be kind, and by nature, I tend to be kind. And so that affects my dialogue choices, and I'm hovering over the, you know, the really abrupt, cruel answer. Well, I suppose cruel, but direct, let's say. Just telling it like it is. I'm hovering over that going, and I'm trying hard to click the mouse button to, on the direct answer, but it won't let me. My brain won't let me. I have to go to the kind thing. Yeah. And it's frustrating. It's really frustrating because you just want to sit the character down and say, look, you kind of drive yourself into a corner.
You see, when I deprived him of talking about psychology, he thought he's going to turn this bit into psychology, so I'm going to stop him and say, talk about the game, not your mental state.
But that's the point. That is the game.
Okay.
That, unfortunately, that is the game. In terms of how the game, you know, in terms of the scenery and everything like that, it's gorgeous. In terms of the actual story, it's weak sauce.
Okay.
And that's the big problem, because you spend so much time in conversation with the main female character, talking about your history, talking about the things that went wrong in your personal histories, because apparently she's always been obsessed with your character. And, you know, there's a conversation that happens between her and one of her other friends, and she says she just needs your character. And you're like, okay, right, that sets off certain bells. You kind of can figure out what's going to happen in the future. But then everything kind of, they go back into the past with the dialogue and talk about everything like that. And it's one of those things where if they hadn't had that conversation at the beginning with her and her friend, and hadn't placed so much focus on the character that you're going to be playing, right, then a lot of what happens afterwards in terms of the dialogue would have been more, you would have been more open to it. But because you go in knowing that she's kind of obsessed with your character, it adds a taint to a lot of the conversations that you have with the character.
Okay.
So, yeah. It's beautiful, but not for me.
It's good you took it, because I think my review would have been a lot harsher.
I can guarantee, right, I can absolutely guarantee this would have made you angry.
It's one of these genres, the walking simulator, that I don't fully understand.
Yeah.
Because it's the way I've always perceived them is they are movies that just so happen to pick the sort of medium of video games, but not sort of mainstream accessible movies, sort of movies by veteran French directors that take place in free rooms.
Yes. The weird thing what you said is Magnificent Truffle Pigs is basically that, but in three fields.
Yeah, well, that kind of got it on the nose, didn't it? But there's an audience for that. It's just in the video game field, I don't know whether it's, well, anything really.
Yeah.
But, see, you know, because these games cost so much less than, you know, typical games, it's a bit more manageable and to put together and, you know, this and that.
Yeah.
And the demand to sell, like, millions of copies isn't quite there, so.
Yeah. I'll tell you something, right? If do you remember that weird cube and chisel game that Peter Molyneux came out with?
No.
It was a weird thing where you basically had to buy chisels and chisel away at this cube.
Oh, vaguely, yeah.
Right. If they did a metal detecting game where you could basically choose an environment and there was something hidden in that environment and you could be the only person to find it and then you win a prize, yeah? That would be an interesting metal detecting game. This sadly isn't.
It's not a metal detecting game, it's a narrative game.
It's a framework. It's a
storytelling game.
Yeah, it's a framework for telling a story, but, you know, yeah.
Okay.
Anyway.
Right, moving on. I'm going to be quicker here because, you know, it's been talked about a lot already, but I got the PlayStation 5, as I mentioned, and the packing of the PlayStation 5 is Astro's Playroom, so I just want to talk about that briefly.
Yeah.
It is a demo. I mean, last year it got lots of sort of Game of the Year nods and contention. It was up there with like the best games of the year, and calling it a game is a bit of a stretch. I I mean, I know games can be short, but at the same time, this is set as a platformer with like 4-hour worlds, and you can do it in 2 hours, easy.
Really?
Yeah. It plays really, really well, and its sort of selling point is the fact that it's literally got all of the gimmicks of the sort of the controller, the DualSense.
Yeah.
Which, fact fans, for people who haven't got a PlayStation 5, don't have all of the things on the controller, because it eats your battery like you won't believe. I mean, I can compare the Xbox to the PlayStation in that regard, and the Xbox controller is much, much better than the DualSense, because I've had the controller last days and days and days, whereas I reckon the PlayStation 5 controller is every 2 days you probably have to recharge it, give or take.
Yeah.
And Astro's Playroom is a game where you really sort of find that the extent of that out, you know. And there's lots of little things as well in the design of the game. There's a bit where you have to climb up the side of a wall with a monkey, and it's really badly explained. It's got like little visual cues on the screen telling you what to do. And I had to YouTube it to figure it out, because honestly, the way it shows and expresses that how you do this thing on the game, it doesn't make sense. It's really badly put together graphically in that regard. Okay. And there's also other little bits, like a little bit which you've seen a lot of footage of, with a fish jumping from side to side, where you got to pull the triggers back to jump. That's really annoying. I'm kind of coming around to say this, that I don't think Astro's Playroom is particularly good.
Wow.
It's a good test for a controller, going around the world and finding these bits of PlayStation history. But yeah, I mean, as a history piece for PlayStation, it's sublime. The Astro little robot fella is really, really cute, and having him dressed up as characters from PlayStation's history is very, very good. But the game itself, it just highlights things that I don't really like. I mean, the triggers are fine. They're good. I can live with that. The rumble is great, because it just, the way it sort of taps on your hands, it makes different surfaces feel like different things. But it's coming back to this thing that this game is very, very reliant on, and its motion controls. And with a traditional controller that you hold in your hand, not like a, I don't know how you'd describe the Wii controller, but it was sort of like a stick, basically, a stick with buttons on it.
Yeah.
Rather than a thing you held in both hands. That works, a stick that you hold in one hand and you sort of, like, you know, move it around, and motion controls are receptive there. But the problem I have with motion controls and a traditional controller that you hold in two hands is the implication that many of these games and games designers have in their work, that suggests that when people play games, they are sat on a perfectly flat surface, sat straight, holding the controller straight, and everything. I don't.
Yeah.
Sort of lean and sort of have my controller resting on one leg or one arm and one arm of the chair, and you know, this or that or the other. So it makes you really aware of how you are holding the controller, and it kind of breaks the illusion of, not the illusion, that's the wrong word. It makes you play the game in a way that you don't feel comfortable. You have a way that you feel comfortable holding the controller, a way you feel sitting comfortable and playing the game feeling comfortable. And the game says, yeah, you're basically crashing into that wall because of how you're doing that. But I don't want to do that. I want to go straight. So I'm going to have to sit up straight, proper posture, like a, you know, a member of the Queen's service.
My nephew, when he plays games, he has a controller almost near his chin, right?
Yeah. This game would wreck him. It wouldn't let him do anything.
It's like he's some kind of hamster with a seed, and he's about to munch on it. It's like right here, right? And he plays it like this.
I've heard people talk about sort of the claw technique as well for pressing buttons. I mean, there's all these
The claw technique?
Look it up. But it's just motion controls I don't like, and I don't think Astro does it particularly well. But as an archive piece for PlayStation's history, I think it's wonderful. As a game in its own right, it is literally a demo. It is literally a demo you can do in about 2 hours.
Showing off what the controller can do.
Yeah.
And the controller's got a bunch of functions which are basically going to go the way of the PlayStation 3 and the PlayStation 4 controller.
Yeah. I mean, the only ones that can have any sort of longevity are the triggers and the rumble.
Yeah.
The rest kind of utterly disposable. Which, when I say the rest, what I essentially mean is the motion controls. The motion controls can go to hell as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. I mean, there's so few games that actually use the motion controls with the PlayStation 3, and there's so few games that use the touchpad with the PlayStation 4.
Yeah. But the haptics are very, very good, because it's haptics in conjunction with the microphone in the controller. So it's sound and vibration at the same time, and it just makes it sound very... It feels very, very good to just wander, but turn everything from strong to sort of regular. Otherwise, your battery will just... right down to the bottom.
Right. Okay. Moving from that then to a game that is... how do I just... This is going to be weird, but follow me on this. Right. So, back in 2007... A Korean author called Hee Sung Nam started writing a series and publishing it called The Legendary Moonlight Sculptor. And in that novel series, which is now like 57 volumes long, and is very, very, very popular. And in that, he's got a character called Lee Hyun, who plays a character called Weed, who plays online video games. And he started playing this new virtual reality MMO called Royal Road, which he is basically kicking everyone's ass at. So, Royal Road is a virtual world, probably the most well-realized virtual world in fiction, so Ernest Cline can go suck an egg. Anyway, imagine taking that virtual reality game world and then turning it into a mobile game where you see characters from the actual novel series who are also part of that world. You see them, but you don't actually play as any of them. You have your own character in this virtual world, which is now a mobile game. Because that is the Royal Road that forms the basis of Moonlight Sculptor, the mobile game. Did you follow that?
I wasn't really listening, but I assume people who are watching this are. Because he's talked about this sort of thing a lot, so it's just white noise to me by this point.
It's not that. Basically, they took the virtual world from the novel, turned it into a mobile game, but you then see characters from the novel trotting around in the mobile game, but you don't get to play as any of them. They're off doing their own thing. You have to play as your own character, which I kind of like. Right, because yes, I am playing Moonlight Sculptor, and I've been playing it since it was officially released in the West. Because obviously I don't speak Korean, so I couldn't play the Korean version. And I'm surprised at how much game is in there. And I mean, by game, I mean solid game. And this is before, this is before you get to the pay to win stuff. Because there are pay to win bits in there, but you don't need them. A lot of the game is focused on you developing as a player, you growing as a player. I mean, I've got to level 50 already, and I haven't had to pay a damn thing. Haven't had to pay anything to get to level 50. I'm pretty handy in a fight. I've got my own classes. There's multiple classes. There are hidden classes as well. There's stacks and stacks of quests you can do. There's massive areas to explore. You can have pets. You can have summons. You can have a house in different places. You can do all sorts in this game, and I'm surprised at just how diverse and how open it is as a game. Really, really surprised. I thought Genshin Impact was one avenue where games could go with mobile devices, but now Moonlight Sculptor has shown me that there is an alternative when it comes to online mobile RPGs, which are quite open-ended in terms of the player base. It doesn't force you to basically go on raids with other people, for example, that you don't know. You can team up people just at random, or you can just join in a raid and automatically you're part of a team. You don't have to go looking for people.
Okay.
Which is a nice thing, because most of the time when I play games like this, I don't want to really talk to other people. I'm playing it basically for me. I'm not playing it to make friends, you know?
Aren't you the life of the party?
Well, it's not that. It's just basically a lot of these...
I know. I'm just teasing.
I play games mainly for escapism. I play them mainly for the story. And weirdly enough, Moonlight Sculptor, because I know the story, what I want to do is visit the places from the story. You know, so I want to go to the Forbidden Zones. I want to basically visit the Kingdom of Arpen. I want to basically go and see these things that I've read about in the book.
He's LARPing, ladies and gentlemen.
I'm not LARPing. I'm curious to see them.
Call him A and B. Call him A and B.
Right, I'll admit, I have a soft spot for this game because of the subject matter. I will admit that. But even with the subject matter, if it was a crap game, I would have said it's a crap game, right? If it was a pay-to-win game, I would have said straight away, it's a pay-to-win game, don't play it, right?
It's worse. There's worse than pay to win in that space of mobile games as well. There's pay to play.
This isn't pay to play either, which is
you've only got so much stamina, and if you want to continue playing, you've got to pay.
Right. I've played this for 4 hours straight without having... and literally, I had to plug my phone into the charger and kept playing for like an extra hour and a half after my battery started running out.
Ooh, you shouldn't do that. It's not good for the phone.
Yeah, but I mean, I was in the middle of a session. A 4 hour session that, number one, didn't cost me a penny. Number two, I had fun with. And number three, you know, I ended up getting pets and a buddy and summons and all sorts because of
the
that
only,
session.
The only question that matters for this is, does it work or will it work for people who don't know what the hell Moonlight Sculptor is?
Yeah, yeah, because all it's doing is introducing you to this game world called Royal Road. I mean, there is a little bit of meta where you start off in the real world and then you enter your VR cabin in the real world and then you're into Royal Road and you create your character. And I suppose they had to do that because of the context of what the novel is, okay? But when you're in the VR world, you don't really leave. You're basically in the VR world of Royal Road and you're basically playing in there and that's it. And there's all sorts to do. There's loads of characters to talk to. There's a lot of thought that's gone into this. I'm actually surprised.
Okay, that's a pretty good note to end on. My next one is the three games that I was talking about. And there's been two that have been released recently. The one, the bigger profile one, let's not lie about anything. It's Mass Effect Legendary Edition.
Yeah.
And I don't think I'd want to play that again, really, because I played number two a lot.
Yeah.
Trying to save every single character. I don't think I ever did it, but, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah, I know several people who, I don't know, maybe I hesitate to say that their heart is in the right place because their reasons for not playing the Legendary Edition of Mass Effect are kind of crass.
There's lots of things in there which, yeah, kind of gross.
They don't want to play it. Yeah, they don't want to play it because of the censorship.
Kind of gross. But the other one is Ninja Gaiden Collection.
Yeah, just try and censor that game.
It's collecting Sigma versions, not the black version. I think the hard code was actually lost. So unfortunately, if you've got a version of that on the Xbox, whatever it is, it's worth its weight in gold, essentially.
Original Xbox, yeah.
But yes, it's collecting the Sigma versions, which is fine. The gameplay is the same. It's just the difficulty curve is a bit more forgiving or unforgiving, depending on which version of the game it is. So yeah, it's collecting those three together. I played it on the PlayStation 5. I don't know what difference is there, but it did load very, very quickly, which is good for a game like this, because going back to its original iteration, it loaded very, very slowly. And it still has a few trappings of that. I mean, number one, in which you play Ryu Hayabusa and someone tries... I mean, I'm not going to go into the story. Number one, number two, number three. That's as far as I'm going into the story. I'll mention some characters, but, you know, story. It's about a ninja who ninjas stuff. Story is as unessential as you could possibly imagine.
There are demons. He forgot about the demons.
There's demons and the soldiers who become increasingly ninja-like, but, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah.
Number one, if we're going to rank it, it's 2-1-3, just for sort of context. But number one is probably the purest of the lot, in the sense of it doesn't have any of the trappings. It's just sort of pure action. But the reservation with number one is... the game world is very boring. Very, very boring. Even though I had that sort of twang of nostalgia when I go through certain levels that I've clearly done many, many times before, because this is a game series I played to death when I had it originally going back. So there's twangs of nostalgia, but the twangs of nostalgia can only really mask over the fact that you're going from... you know when there's going to be an ambush or something because it's a big open room.
Yeah.
But... this is a game series which I will go on record as saying has the best combat probably ever in any sort of adventure, like martial arts, sword play game. Better than Devil May Cry, better than any of these games.
Better than Bayonetta.
Hands down.
Right.
Because the reason for this is the flexibility of Ryu Hayabusa for a character. In many games, if you run into a wall, you run into a wall.
Yeah.
But if you run into a wall, he'll run up the wall. If you run into a wall at a certain angle, he'll run along the wall at a certain angle. If you run into a wall at a certain angle and it's a corner, he'll run across that wall and jump to the other wall.
Yeah.
Which makes the possibilities of what you can do and what you can achieve staggering.
Yeah.
Much to the point on that where it becomes so staggering that I was playing number three and I thought, hang on, where have I gone? I've gone too fast. Where am I? Where is he? Where's Ryu gone?
Yeah, just to put this into context, right? One conversation that we had while you were playing Ninja Gaiden 2 springs to mind, this new version of Ninja Gaiden 2, because before I'd actually even said hello, he basically said, he started talking about the gameplay of Ninja Gaiden 2. I hadn't even said hello.
Well, yeah, there we go. But number one's good, but the bosses are... In later ones, I think they crack the bosses a bit better. In this one, it's kind of like, what am I supposed to do here? The guy basically shoots constantly. Where am I supposed to get here? What am I supposed to do here? It's not particularly... I mean, games bosses have evolved over the years, and sometimes games bosses are done well, sometimes they're done badly. I think number one's games bosses are pretty bad, honestly. Number two, I mean, I think the problem with number two is always going to be the same as in the game world, is very grey and vanilla. However, the combo system, the way the character moves, the levels, the bosses, if this game world was a little bit more production design to it, it's probably one of my favourite games ever. It's just when you're going from grey room to grey room, from hangar to hangar, from open room to open room, it kind of becomes a bit played out as a game world, but actual playing of it, nothing like it. It is beautiful.
I mean, by the sounds of it, you want Ninja Gaiden Sigma 2 Kiwami.
Yeah, yeah, so like, just flesh out the world.
Yeah.
Give it a bit of like, colour, you know, because it's just such a boring game world, but beautiful, brilliant, well-considered, well-balanced, interesting, and constantly replayable game in that boring game world.
Yeah, which is why I went with Kiwami rather than an actual full-on remake.
Yeah, and number three has a lot of problems that have been reported along, but I kind of forgot about it, because, you know, you play something, I think 2012 this one was originally released,
yeah.
That's 9 years ago, you forget a lot about games that you played 9 years ago. But the problem with this is they've kind of gone a bit too extreme, dropping the E's, you know?
Yeah.
The problem is, in the other ones, he was a ninja, he got... Ryu Hayabusa's an injury, he gets involved with a lot of the world, he does things outside of his little village. That's fine. In this, I mean, just before that, in the number one, he's got a Kunoichi friend.
Yeah.
I can't remember the name of her, but yeah, she helps. You got a mission along with her, and that's usually the worst part of the game. In number two, Ryu's female friend is a buxom American S&M sadomasochistic model, wearing leather and with all of the flesh hanging out, who happens to work for the CIA, so you know it's nice to see that CIA's you know, uniform code is pretty lax.
I don't want to know what the guys are wearing.
Yeah, and number three, the characters and also the acting is improved exponentially, but it's the story which is really the crux of this. Basically, they've turned Ryu Hayabusa into a monster who goes on absolute blind rage lusts. Like, rage. He just loses himself and rage. It's like rage mode. You gotta kill as many people as humanly possible, because if you don't, you will die. You gotta constantly kill. And there's bits in the cutscenes where he just seems like a nice, adjusted guy. And the female character who he's talking with introduces him to his daughter. So you don't introduce that to your daughter. You're basically bathing in other people's flesh 10 minutes ago. It's just so incredibly jarring, and also the combat, I think it's gone too hard, too far, because what I was saying earlier is essentially I lost where I was. He moves so fast I don't know where I've gone. If alright, there I am, I found where I am, and that's kind of hard to keep on top of.
Yeah,
but it's infinitely worth playing. I don't think it does too much. It just basically makes the time load times quicker. It HDFIs it, makes the frame rate steady. You know, the bare minimum for what you want to do for this sort of thing.
Yeah.
But I will absolutely stand by number two. Not just will I stand by number two, I think it may have to go into my top 10 of all time.
Wow.
And by very definition of having a top 10 of all time, not a lot of things have that honour. And this is a game that I'm putting alongside Dead Space, which I constantly talk about. So this isn't me damning with faint praise. Number one is a good warm-up. And number three is a good, oh, you've gone too far. What are you doing there?
Yeah.
But by the sheer averaging out of all of them, this is definitely worth playing. And I think it's only £35. So yeah, definitely get on it. And if this is them basically saying, okay, we're going to do number four, I will be so happy.
Yeah. And it's a shame that that you didn't have Black as a comparison piece with this. It is a shame because I think that would have been, that would have made a nice kind of I don't know what the word is. You know when you hold something up to a mirror.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the one thing I will say is I had to turn the difficulty down on number three.
Yeah.
To hero mode, I think they call it, because it was so fast I couldn't defend myself very well.
Yeah.
I didn't know where I was going, I didn't know where he was, and I just sort of finally caught myself. So, oh, like, yeah, I don't know what I'm doing. There I am. Okay, I found myself. I'm good to go. So, yeah, it's definitely worth playing. I kind of loved it.
Cool.
But then again, right. I love the original, so that's kind of a moot point.
Yeah, exactly. For my final game, right, there are a lot of things about this game that I really, really like. Let me get this right out of the way. Number one, it reminds me of the original Fallout games, Fallout 1 and 2. In a big, big way.
Okay.
Number two, it's got beautiful scenery. The word beautiful is in the title. Number three, it's sci-fi. It's kind of post-apocalyptic in a sense. And number four, the accents are amazing. It's like the... right. Do you remember District 9?
You say what the game is.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you remember District 9?
Yes.
Right? District 9, science fiction movie set in South Africa. Everyone's got really strong South African accents, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Now imagine that in a video game where every character has really strong South African accents and the South African vernacular is strong, because that's what Beautiful Desolation is. Beautiful Desolation, it's by the Brotherhood, which is basically Nick and Eric Bischoff. And
taking a break from wrestling, I guess.
I don't know if it's that Bischoff.
I doubt it. It's just I have to bring it up. Sorry.
But anyway, The thing about Beautiful Desolation is you play as a guy called Mark, and about 10 years previous to the events of the game, this thing called the Penrose appeared in the skies of South Africa, and your other half passes away, and now, 10 years later, you are a journalist, you think you've uncovered the truth of the Penrose, and you want your brother to take you up on his chopper, and your brother Don has a magnificent beard, and in the bits where you actually see Mark's haircut, it's... He looks like a 70s porn model, which is a bit of a...
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of fitting because I played Wasteland.
Yeah, yeah.
And I tried to make a character called Tommy Porno, but the game wouldn't let me. And it feels like one of the characters in this is Tommy Porno.
Yeah.
By the way, I toned him down to call him Tommy Knockers, which is even worse, I think. But, you know, go on.
Yeah, Stephen King's Tommy Knockers.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Full Desolation, though.
Beautiful Desolation. Right, there are elements to this game. It's obviously it's isometric, and you basically go around exploring stuff. There's virtually no combat in this game, which is where it kind of deviates from Fallout 1 and 2. But in terms of the storytelling, it's really, really strong. There is a definite story here. There's a definite mystery here. There are things to investigate. There are characters to interact with. And they're all, like, fully voiced, and they've all got really strong South African accents. You know, everyone in the game is like, proper South African, and it's such a nice deviation.
Just to relate that, I mean, I think it was, what was it, Dragon Quest VIII, was
yeah.
it? Everybody had an English accent, and it just,
yeah.
when you, every game has American, you don't realise how refreshing it is when a game isn't.
Oh, God, yes, exactly, that's the point I'm making. It's such a nice deviation from the usual American fare. And I kept playing the game just to hear more characters talk, because I was like, this is really cool. This is amazing.
Yeah, it's so refreshing, you know.
Yeah.
You don't realize you need that break, honestly.
Yeah. I mean, even the cyborg dog called Pooch, who is female, right? And that's just because they've done it like that, okay? Is, you know, really strong South African accent. And I just thought, this is like, wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, this is, I don't know what the game's like, but it kind of relates to a point we're talking about on a recent episode of Impossible Mission, where I want games to be from all corners of the world, because all corners of the world are beautiful and have stories to tell, perspectives of their own. Not walkness, just broadness.
Yeah.
This sounds very broad, in both senses.
There's so many diverse characters to meet, right? So many diverse characters, and you could basically, You can choose to be cruel. You can choose to be kind. You can basically, in the same way as the original Fallout games. And a lot of the way that they actually do the actual dialogue bits reminds me of the original two Fallout games, the way that they actually frame it. So mm-hmm. it's like a little video thing at the top, where, and then you have the... And then you have the captions for the text from what's being said, which is fully voiced, and then you have your options at the bottom. And that's exactly the way it used to be in Fallout. And that's why I get such big Fallout vibes from this game. The original Fallout games, that is. And that immediately drew me in for me, because I love Fallout 1 and 2. I think they're amazing games. And so I was immediately drawn into this. It's dystopian, it's sci-fi, it's my jam totally. Problem I mean, is
just on that shows how very different people we are, doesn't it? Rob's yeah. jam is very just desolate dystopian sci-fi with strong characters. Man's ninjas can run on walls and stab stuff.
Exactly.
Very different.
The problem is when this came out on the PC, you can tell it's very much a point and click adventure type game.
What did you play this on?
PlayStation 4 Pro.
That's always the problem, isn't it? Sort of yeah. making a point and click, a controller game. I don't know if any games ever really cracked it.
The port from PC is good, and the graphics are great on the PlayStation 4 Pro. Dialogue's great, the music is great, everything's great, except there are niggly bits, and it's always going to be those niggly bits that make you go, damn you, game!
Once a developer figures out how to make this transition, it's going to open up so many games to be so playable on consoles and open up like so much to like an audience that will never experience it. But it's got to take that one game.
I know how to do it, and it's something the Dreamcast already did. Add a mouse and keyboard to the console.
But the Dreamcast also went under from having a million peripherals. So, you know.
Yeah, I know. I'm just saying that, you know, the PlayStation 4 has already sold 110 million, you know, consoles. It's not going to go under anytime soon. They've gone on the PlayStation 5.
It wouldn't be the worst thing to have a keyboard and mouse peripheral for your consoles. Yeah, that wouldn't be a bad idea at all, actually.
Exactly. Because then, when you're making a port from a PC, you don't have to stress about, let's make it compatible with controllers. You're like, hey, they've got mouse and keyboards on there as well. So that's easy enough now.
Yeah.
Job done.
But is the game worth playing?
Yes.
Or is it worth playing on PC?
It's absolutely worth playing on PC. Yes, there are a couple of niggly bits. There are a couple of bits where the frames freeze a little bit, and the screen judders a little bit. And there's a couple of bits where it just kind of the perspective is a little bit distorted. And there are some bits because you get a ship where you can fly around on the map, and there are bits where I was trying to see just how big the map was. And all I got was like, you know, when you look at the picture and you move the picture a little bit too far across and then you just see the edge of the picture, and then nothing else.
Let's just say yes.
Basically, it's like, so...
You don't need to explain it, just move on.
I think it's a great game. I think it's a great game, and I've continued playing it because it is a fascinating idea. The whole idea of your place in time and space... You know, you being fixed point, but everything else is moving around you rather than the other way around. So it's not that you're being catapulted through space and time because of something, but you become the fixed point and you have to try and fix everything else because you're the fixed point.
Sci-fi shenanigans.
Yes, sci-fi shenanigans.
It's easier to explain it like that, Rob.
Yes.
Like Ninja Gaiden's about ninja shenanigans, each one of the games. It's just ninja shenanigans.
Yeah. It's totally my jam. Absolutely worth playing. You can forgive the niggly bits. And if you're a fan of Fallout 1 and 2, then absolutely this is a game that you want to play.
Metal detecting shenanigans. It's an easy way to explain away any game.
Technically, yeah, I suppose metal detecting shenanigans is how you explain every game.
Yes. And on that, we've just conquered games and synopsis is there. Job over.
Wasn't that Metal Gear Solid? He has to go and find the big metal thing. Metal detecting shenanigans.
Yes, basically. But if you like this show, please do support us. There's a Patreon that's just flashed on the screen every so often. Go over there and throw us a few pounds and get some exclusive content for the trouble. And other than that, though, please do like, subscribe, kick that notification bell to keep up to date with all of our stuff, because we are a small channel and small channels need a lot of support, whereas big ones have already had enough. Give that support awards instead. But yeah, until next time, Rob will be properly Xboxed. Yeah.
I will be what?
Yeah, Xboxed. It's a process, Rob, and it's painful and it involves butt stuff. But until then, thank you for listening and watching if you're on podcast providers or YouTube, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.